أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماؤه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفرطان ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد محمد وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله أعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والذين جاهدوا فينا لنهدينهم سبلنا وإن الله لمع المحسنين. صدق الله العلي العظيم. اللهم صل على محمد. Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 8. For the past few nights, we have been looking at some of those barriers, those mawani', those impeding forces that sometimes block us from achieving this desired identity. We understand the importance of it. We may even get the factors that we talked about in the middle of the ashra. But these hurdles that we have, these barriers that we have, these forces that we have, that either consciously, subconsciously pull us away from this path, have to be understood. Now, last night I spoke about the fact that if we are not certain on the path of the identity, we won't cultivate it. It's very simple. If I don't believe in the Islamic path or the Islamic identity, if I have doubt, which is crippling doubts, to the point where it's borderline kufr, that I believe that deen doesn't have my answers, any talk of cultivation of Islamic identity, of course, will go in one ear and out the other. So we talked about the idea of converting that doubt into certainty and making sure that once we are certain of something, of course, then we are proud to identify with it. It is and always will be a lifelong mission for us to continue to build up that level of certainty. And the example I gave last night of Nabi Ibrahim alayhi salam, where he asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I want to know, show me, arani, kaifa tuhyi al-mauta, how do you bring life back, or how do you bring the dead back from life? And then when he asked a very important question, قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ, you don't believe? He says, no, I believe. I just want this itminan of the qalb. I want this security. I want it to be inside of my heart. I want this certainty inside of my heart. So it is a human reality. It is an innate desire of ours to always be certain in everything that we do. Now, that has levels to it. I talked about that yesterday, inshallah. Tonight, we look at one more barrier. These are critical. To understand tonight's barrier, let's go a little bit back. Surah Hujurat is the 49th chapter of the Quran. I asked my young guys to visit this surah often if you can. Not a lot of verses in it, I think 18 altogether. It is an encompassing picture of ethics and akhlaq and morals in Islam. How to behave, how to address individuals, how to see yourself, certain realities that are relevant in all generations. In this beautiful chapter of Surah Hujurat, verse number 13, Allah points to a reality that I think affects all of us. In a very famous way, he says, Ya ayyuhan nas, inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha. O mankind, we have created you from a man and a woman. وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلًا لِتَعَارَفُوا. We have placed you. Allah says, we've placed you. جَعَلْنَا يعني we've placed you in nations and tribes. So you may get to know each other. This placing within tribes is a whole discussion in tafsir. And this need that we have today of belongingness is actually a fitri innate need to belong to something. It comes from this form of Quranic tribalism. Now, of course, Allah now, right after, right, إِنَّ أَكْرَمُكُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ, just so you know that, you know, I don't want divisions from you, nor do I want this idea that you think one tribe is better than the other, or this, you know, meritless sort of, you know, elitism. No. The belongingness, of course, comes from me, but if you want any sort of fadilat and distinction, أَتْقَاكُمْ, you have to be pious. But what is produced from this verse is a very beautiful reality. We all have an innate need to belong to something. That's why sometimes you see my young guys belong to a group that is toxic, it's destructive. They know it, but these guys make them feel like they belong to that group. And sometimes that need to belong to a group is so strong, it veils any other qualities of that group. Flat out, they would tell me, I said, bhai, I know they're not a good group. They're not the best people, but I am a brother to them. And so I'm going to stay because they make me feel like I belong. So this sense of belongingness is huge. I talked about that very briefly as one sentence a couple of nights ago in the beginning, where I said that the first tribe that a child now looks to belong themselves to is the family, right? They just want to be around Mama and Baba. They just want, you know, their eyes light up when there is a family event happening. A family game night, going to dinner to the restaurant together, right? Look at the young ones, their eyes are lit up, right? Doesn't matter, we could be doing anything. Silly games, a puzzle, doesn't matter. If we're doing it together, because the tribe is together, the kids are on the moon. And our job as parents is to continue to make them feel like they belong in this tribe of ours. Like I said, the moment they feel like they don't belong, they'll go out looking for their other tribe. Now, that's not my topic tonight. This strength of the need to belong also produces this sometimes debilitating fear of rejection. Makes sense, right? We have a strong sense to belong. When that's taken from us and we're scared, all of a sudden now we've had this fear of rejection. Now what if now I'm trying to enter this tribe of that I think is going to be good for me and the tribe rejects me? That's a big fear of a lot of us. Not just young people, all of us. And so naturally when you go to develop an Islamic identity in an un-Islamic state, and sometimes where they are hostile towards the very identity you're trying to now cultivate, you have this sort of deep-rooted fear that what if they reject me once I begin to identify with this path? When I say they, could be anybody. Your friends, your co-workers, your classmates, even sometimes your own family. I've seen people that try to climb a little bit of the ladder of piety, and the first ones now to stop them are their own families. So this has to be addressed, right? The fear of rejection is a huge barrier for us. What if they don't accept me? What if I'm too religious? What if I lose my friends? What if my spouse doesn't come near me? What if all these things happen? And that fear, you know, chips away at us to the point where we become a little bit complacent. I'm happy where I am. I talked about that yesterday. Not only am I happy where I am, I believe where I am is successful. Now, for us who are a little bit older, we can deal with rejection. But for a 16, 17-year-old impressionable heart, it plays with their mind. It plays with their ego. It plays with their self-conscious. They don't have any confidence if this group rejects them, if that group rejects them. So there is this sometimes strong need to fit in and to please, even though it's bending my own sort of a tarbiyat and nature that I have inside of me. Look, Surah An-Kabut has a very beautiful, powerful verse. And before that, let me give you a little bit of context of this verse. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. Surah An-Kabut is a Makki surah. And majority of this surah was revealed during the latter stages of the Makki movement. And as many of you know, those years were very tough on Rasulullah. Shibi Abu Talib banished, sanctioned, told to leave his own city. Very difficult time in those 3 years for the Muslims. Now during those times, I want you to imagine, and the sha'an in nuzul, the reasons by which, or the events by which this verse was triggered, tells us that one of the groups that of course gravitates towards the Prophet are the young, as you know. And so these young guys now who are around the Holy Prophet in Shibu Abu Talib, an area outside the outskirts of Mecca that is really scarce in terms of resources, not all of their friends or their group or their circle now said labbaik to the Prophet's call. There were some who stayed in Mecca. There were some who simply didn't make that plunge into Islam. So now this group of theirs that they grew up with now is split into half. Half the group is in with the Holy Prophet. The other half of their friends are in the streets of Mecca. These are young guys. And so Tafsir says that a group of them approached the Holy Prophet and said, look, we have very close friends in Mecca. We know them since we were a child. Now they didn't have tawfiq to answer your call, but of course our hearts yearn for them, long for them. We haven't seen them in months, years. What do we do? I mean, we can't go there, and there's a crossroads here, a little bit of tension because we said labbaik to your call, and they're still on their belief. And then this verse came along. If I'm not mistaken, it's verse number 8 of Surah An-Kabut. Allah now answers the Holy Prophet, or answers this group. It's a beautiful question. I think this is something that is faced by a lot of people, a lot of my young guys. They're part of groups, toxic groups sometimes, knowing full well there is toxicity in that group. And I know better not to be with these people. I have a tough time separating myself from them. I talked about the idea of the triggers of thought a couple of nights ago, and the circle you surround yourself in, of course, is one of those triggers. So now the verse, right? Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna alladhina amanu wa amilu salihat linudkhilannahum fis salihin. For the ones who have faith and the ones who do good, amanu wa amilu salih. You have to have that condition. If you have that condition, Allah says, we will place you amongst the salihin. We'll find you friends that are just like you. We'll place you in groups that have the same goals as you, the same iman as you, to some degree, of course. You don't need to sit there and fight your conscience to please them. I think there's a lot of guys, a lot of my youth today, When they examine their circle of influence, they might be a little bit surprised to find out that I ended up with this group of people. I never thought maybe 10 years ago that I'd be spending my extra time with these people. But sometimes, hearts kind of attract each other, right? God basically is saying that, look, tell them, Ya Rasulullah, that don't worry about loneliness. Don't worry about being isolated. Don't worry about being rejected. We will place you amongst groups. We'll find you friends. We'll place you with people that are just like you. Salihin. لِنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ. There's two types of emphasis in this verb. The lam is emphasis. The shadda on the noon is also emphasis. Noon is thaqil, it's called in Arabic. Meaning what? Hatman, Hatman, Saddar Sad, 1,000%. God says, we are the ones that will place you, Dakhala, Fis Salihin, with a group that is amongst the pious ones. Provided inna alladhina amanu wa amilu salih. Don't sell your soul out. So a lot of guys out there who are surrounded by people and they have to push that conscience down. Quiet that voice down that's telling you this is not a good idea. This is not a good idea. You know better. You come from a very pious household. Your parents worked very hard to raise you and they have to push it down. It's very tiring and exhausting to do that. And after a while, you end up losing respect for yourself. But the reason why they continue to push that voice down is because they don't want to be ostracized, isolated, called out, rejected. So sometimes the fear of rejection actually comes over and hijacks the voice of conscience. It's a strong, strong fear. So sometimes I think our sisters who want to start hijab in their life a little bit later on in their life, they have to stop and think, okay, my coworkers will see me tomorrow. My friends will see me tomorrow. How do I answer, for example, this person if I'm a business person, a businesswoman, my clients, my patients, if I'm a doctor, am I ready to face all of that? And if they are, I've seen it. Bismillah, they start. Because one discussion I'm going to have with all of you before the day of Ashura is this need to be distinct. This need to sometimes go a little bit away from the current. That inshallah is in a couple of days, maybe even tomorrow. We'll see how it goes. But tonight, however, we have to tackle this fear of rejection. Now, sometimes, and I'll give you my own example, okay? Sometimes, there are people, and by the way, I always appreciate this, there are people who go out of their way to give me feedback on the lectures. Like, I find it to be very humbling when somebody goes out of their way, they're busy, they have kids, they have work, to message me in whatever platform they message me on, to say thank you very much. And they're very, very polite. They're very encouraging. Every so often you get the hate mail. You do. And, things like, that was an embarrassing set of lectures you delivered. Things like, your approach is very misogynistic. It's very male dominated. You say he too much. Let's say, for example, there's a whole group out there that are females. You assume only males hear you. Great feedback, by the way. It really is. Sometimes you hear things like your topic this year was not so great. Last year was better. Right? And sometimes so much so that, people refer to me as half an alim. I don't wear an imam on the member. All these things come directly to my email, which is great. That's fine. Alhamdulillah. It's a really thick skin. Alhamdulillah, I have. Sometimes it's too thick. I have really thick skin. And sometimes, it's the idea that, I'll focus, and literally if I do it like 20 emails I get of feedback across 5-6 years, 3 of them will be a little bit negative. That's nothing. Otherwise, 17 emails changed my life because of you, all these, And you would think that these 3 wouldn't have an impact on me. I'm a human being. If my focus becomes only the 3 emails, please follow this very carefully. If my focus is the fact, if I get really, really impacted by one person telling me, basically, I rejected your efforts this Muharram. Didn't benefit, wasted my time. And I'm not, for example, putting the same amount of weight on those lectures that are the opposite in their feedback. Very generous in their words. Then after a while, I have to stop and ask myself, am I impacted by their words and their rejection? Or are they shining a light on my own individual rejection? Right? If there's a voice inside of me that basically is whispering to me in the heart of my hearts of my hearts, and somebody external from me, outside of me, doesn't even know me now, echoes those words, you would tell yourself, see, I knew it. I knew I was half an alim. I knew these lectures weren't good. I knew it. I knew it. Baba, there were 17 other emails. No, but this guy really impacted me. After a while, it has nothing to do with them and everything to do with how you see yourself. I'll give you a very simple story. They say there was a monk on a canoe, paddles out to the middle of the lake. Okay? He's by himself, a beautiful crisp morning, gets out there, and then he stops rowing. He puts his paddle inside the canoe, allows the canoe to kind of be taken by the water. He's sitting there now, his eyes are closing in, surrounded by nature, very serene environment, and it begins to kind of fall deep into his sort of nirvana, irfanic trance. His little moment of meditation, contemplation, this and that. He's in a very, very peaceful place. And just as he's about to really, really get deep into that peace, he gets hit by another canoe. And now the anger goes like this. And turn around to confront this canoe, and the canoe is empty. It's kind of undocked itself from the shore, and you know, the water kind of made its way and it hit that canoe. And right away he had his nirvana moment. He had his irfanic moment. He realized the anger I feel is not in the canoe. It's empty. It was always inside of me. The canoe triggered it. The canoe bumped it. So I can yell and scream at the canoe, who is this, who's in charge here, where's the manager? Or I can turn inwards and say, it just took one empty canoe to rock my foundation. A lot of times, you know, we have to be a little bit careful of how we take the words of individuals. How we assume that this person will reject this new identity of mine. And the question that I have, and it's very difficult to turn inwards, is the reason why we put so much weight on that rejection because I've already rejected that identity? And now I just need one more person to rubber stamp it. Even though the reality is that I've seen people that they find God. I've seen youth in this very city, east and west now, go through this journey, trying to figure things out, up and down. And they end up in a beautiful, pious place, God-fearing, God-conscious kid. Amazing. I couldn't believe it. Sometimes I don't see youth in the city for years. And after a while, when I see them, mashallah, amazing. Involved in a community, right? He looks the part, for example. Beautiful questions. You can tell he's well-read in Islam. And my heart tells me that a lot of people must be very proud of him. I know that in our Al-Mahdi, for example, we have immense pride at the fact that a lot of our youth now are in Qum right now in the Hawza. They've taken that very, very important step and we have a lot of pride. So it's not even like the rejection is going to be loud. Sometimes it's a low whisper. Sometimes it's one person that will come to that kid and say, why are you going to Qum, to Najaf? You're in your 20s. This is the time for you to live your life and make your millions. You're going to go there and sit in a cave on top of a mountain? You have it easy here. That's a desert there. One person, but 15 others, shabash, mashallah, right? All sorts of stuff. We're so proud of you. But all those are drowned out. The one whispering guy in the corner, for some reason, has my ear. That is a reflection of the fact that I myself am not sold on the path that I'm on. That's it. So a fear of rejection is actually an alarming bell. That's why some emotions that we have, while the West and other sciences might tell you that these are destructive emotions and they're heavy emotions, and you are now to relieve yourself of that weight. Islam says, wait a second now. What might seem like a difficult emotion on paper is actually a very good emotion for you. Guilt is one, and rejection is one. The fear of rejection is also one. That fear is very important. Guilt is, I tell you, sometimes when we commit a sin when nobody sees us. We're behind closed doors, nobody is there, it's me, myself, and me, and I commit a sin. And right after I commit a sin, I have this huge weight of guilt on me. The guilt would make sense if I committed the sin in front of everybody. If my kids saw me, if my wife saw me, if all of you saw me, oh my God, that guilt I have would kill me. But no one saw me. I'm behind closed doors. There's no cameras here. Nothing's going. My phone was off. Everything was... The fact that you still feel guilt when you're alone, you should tell you that your heart of your heart still what? Recognizes another force inside that room. And that guilt is telling you that you're never alone. He's always Havir and Navir. He's always there. Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala. Half of Tawbah, he says, is regret and remorse. Is this guilt that we feel. If you commit a sin, he says, and you don't feel remorse or guilt afterwards, be very, very scared. Either you've downplayed the sin, or you just kind of, you know, made it a minor sin. And as Imam Ali says, a minor sin in your eyes is a major sin in his eyes. Now, you might go to some other psychologist, will say, you know what, you don't need to feel guilty. You can remove that. Yes, no doubt. When we hold on to things, harbor things, I'm not saying all of guilt, but sometimes guilt now, we feel right away, is a sort of a sign that there's still a conscience inside of you. It's not all bad emotion. A fear of rejection is good. If you're worried, for example, if I'm worried that, okay, how will people view my lecture tonight? It forces me and it sets off alarm bells inside of me. That, okay, if you're afraid about that, go back and review your notes. Make sure everything is solid. Everything is logical, it makes sense, it flows, all that. So it forces me to really perfect my craft, perfect my intention, perfect my delivery. If I didn't have the fear of rejection, you know what comes about? Ghurur, the ego. They won't reject me. Everything I deliver is bomb. It's beautiful. Top notch. When the fear of rejection is removed, you become somebody who ends up doing a little bit of, they say, you know, khud parasti, worshipping yourself. So a fear of rejection can be very positive. Absolutely. But it does require us to remove the element from the outside and begin to look inwards. Have I already preemptively rejected this path and just waiting for one person to tell me, not a good idea. I knew it, not a good idea. Because if we hold on to that for too long, the fear, it becomes something that might even cripple us. I'll give you a very simple example. Before that one, laut salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. I want you to imagine that you are holding a very light bottle of water. That wasn't planned, it just happened to be there. Light bottle of water. Okay? I hold it right now, it's okay, it's light. I'm a big boy, I can handle it. Not a big deal. If I hold it like this for about 5 minutes, I'm good. 10 minutes, I'm good. An hour? Like this. 2 hours? 3 hours? 18 hours? Has the volume changed in this bottle? No. Has the weight changed? No. It's still 500 milliliters. But for some reason, it's the heaviest bottle I've ever carried in my life. Now my arm is shaking. Now I have to put it down. Now this thing becomes unbearably heavy. Nothing has changed, but I held on to it for too long. When you hold on to things for too long and you don't address them properly, they become too heavy to bear. And everything, I mean, stress, anxiety, depression, these things require an outlet. And everybody has their own individual outlet, inshallah, whatever that is. Prayer, journaling, a spouse, a coffee run, whatever it is. This fear of rejection has to be tackled, but internally. And that's the difficult part. We're okay when it comes to others. We have other people figured out. We really do. If you can work on this, brother, you'd be perfect. You need to work on this. Oh, all sorts of, you know, I can tell you exactly what you need to do. But when you look in the mirror, like right now, this glass is in front of me, I can see myself in the glass. It's quite strange. That's why I know my hair, my hat is way off. I can see myself. That is scary. The person in the mirror is telling you, okay, what do you need to work on? And I, at that moment, I have nothing. You ask me about my wife and my kids and my parents and my brothers and my cousins. Oh, I have a long list. When it comes to me, I don't have anything. And the reality is that if I am that journey towards Allah, I have to know me. Again, another simple example, I'm sorry. You decide to drive to Vancouver. Long drive. Right? Cross country. Drive through Manitoba, you know, get through the beautiful area of Banff, for example, and then get into BC. The first thing you'll do is you'll figure out what is my vehicle. Okay? And you want to make sure that you know the vehicle inside and out. Full tank of gas, oil, check the brakes, check the tires, all that. You know how fast the car can go. You know how long the car can drive. You know, for example, I can't go past 120 on the highway. You know, after about 8-9 hours, got to pull over, grab a hotel, start again in the morning. You know that because you know the vehicle. Because if, God forbid, between here and Vancouver, your car breaks down, you won't get to your destination. The vehicle, the wasila, is very, very important. And you must know the ins and outs. Don't push the accelerator too much. Don't do this. Don't rev this. Don't do that. Okay, no problem. Don't overheat it. Turn the AC low. You know everything about that vehicle, because that vehicle will get you to your destination. The I that I talked about 4 or 5 nights ago is the vehicle from me to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The self that I am stuck with from now until I arrive on the day of judgment. Not the body, the self. And if I don't know the self now, God forbid, halfway through the journey, I'm going to collapse. And we've seen collapses happen. That's why they say one of the most important knowledges or sciences you can have is ilm al-nafs, knowing yourself. Huge topic. Oh my God, huge topic. But part of that is to know your triggers. Part of that is to know your trauma. Part of that is to know, how am I going to react? Literally, somebody can start talking to me and I know what they're saying and I won't even let them finish the statement. Don't say it. If you have feedback for my lectures, I don't want to hear it. I'm not convinced myself. So I don't want anyone to reaffirm or confirm my own insecurities. In the process now, we become unjust to ourselves. We put all the weight on one individual. We don't put any weight to 12, 13 other comments. Remember, I talked about the power of thought. These are all connected now. Power of thought a couple of nights ago. I said, when you are convinced of a certain thought, the world now, your lens now, is looking to confirm that thought. If you're a failure, if you're bad at math, everything you go through either confirms that, or if it doesn't, then you say, I got lucky. Doesn't mean anything. You downplay it. Surah Nisa talks about the idea, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, kunu qawamina bil qist. O you who believe, be the qawamin, be the ones who upright, who establish, who maintain, who regulate what? This idea of justice. To the point where shuhada'a lillahi, you are witnesses for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, meaning God sees you, sorry, others see you, and they're reminded of God. Walau ala anfusikum. Even against yourself, be just. And we're not just to ourselves. We're either lax or we are excessive. That's why the prophet says, you know, if you want to have a litmus test in terms of your spiritual development, the last person that you should consult is yourself. What a beautiful release. The last person to tell you how good you're doing in terms of God is you. That's why it's important to marry the right person, surround yourself with the right people. So they can sit there and say, look, you're going this way, let's bring you back. I can't do that. Either I'm too hard on myself, where every mistake I make, chalo bhai, jahannam, that's it. Confirmed. I'm a lost cause. Baba, you're 15 years old, man. You'll figure it out. You'll slip, you'll fall, you'll get back up, it's okay. Or I'm really, really, you know, I am my biggest cheerleader. No one like me at all. If no one gets into Jannat, I will for sure. If I'm not there, kya fayda hai? It's empty Jannat, empty heaven. Oh. That's why when you look at the discussion in theology on Ma'ad, the Day of Judgment, they talk about this small court inside of you. A small sense of judgment inside of you that's supposed to give you a glimpse of the major court or judgment on the Day of Judgment. Meaning what? Inside of us, we have a defendant, we have a judge, we have the jury, we have the lawyers. We become everything. We become the defendant, we become the judge, we become the jury, we defend ourselves, we cross-examine ourselves. All of that happens inside of us, do we not? This last nafsil lawama, loam, yani this idea that regret, remorse, regret, I shouldn't have. That's all happening inside of us. That mini, mini court is there to give you a glimpse of the major court waiting for us on the Day of Judgment. The problem is that we're biased. We're not just. So examine, what are you scared of? What are you afraid of? The one person, the two people, the five people, the seven people of the hundreds you know might sit there and say, is it a good idea for you to start doing this? Is it smart for you to start wearing hijab? You might lose your job. In this economy, you have two small kids. Is it smart for you to start, you know, using your free time to volunteer at the center? You're 18, you have your whole life for that. Establish yourself, go to school, do your master's, right? Work on your business. The center will always be there. Or the other way, where we are convinced of something, 1,000 can tell us no. No, we are convinced of it. Those are internal dakhili discussions that are not easy. I mentioned this idea at Al-Mahdi. Janabi Hur, for a brief moment, climbed on his horse and rode a little bit away from the tents on the Day of Ashura. Just wanted to be a little bit away from everybody. Give me some quiet and silence. Let me figure things out. No external noise. Just me, myself, and me. And when he was able now to get that moment, the result was what? That he went from La'natullah alayh to alayhi salam. Didn't he? He realized, what am I doing? The problem with people like me is that I'm a little bit afraid to find out what might come out. Right? And that's when I said, you know, in the first opening lectures, these are not comfortable conversations. We have to train ourselves to be a little bit uncomfortable. To sit in that discomfort, just a little bit. Knowing full well that you have to kind of view yourself as God views yourself. And that is that somebody who is forgiven. Somebody who's trying. You know, years ago, I gave the example. I think, you know, one of my first month of Ramadan series of lectures was right here at Masumi. I talked about akhlaq. This was easily, I think, in like 2009 or something. Or 10, maybe. And I gave the example of a boxing ring. Or for UFC guys, an octagon, let's say. Now, you know, back in the day, you know, we were talking about Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, and now you have, you know, McGregor, and you have all these other foolish characters who are in the octagon. So I want you to imagine now you have these two fighters inside this ring, and the match is scheduled for, let's say, 10 rounds. Okay. In the first round, one boxer dominates. The boxer being dominated goes back to his corner. He's bleeding. He's cut. He's swollen. At that moment, does his coach throw in the white towel? No. It's round one. He says, look, he got you in round one. Go back out. Have some respect. Get him in round two. And this back and forth battle happens for the full 10 rounds. Nobody gets knocked out. And then finally, when they announce the winner, they raise the hand of a guy whose face is messed up. Please follow the example. Messed up. There's blood from his ear. His one eye is swollen shut. He can barely talk, but he's smiling. One tooth is missing, but he's the winner. Ajib. He's the winner. If this is the state of the winner, imagine what the loser looks like. He can barely talk. He can't even look, but he's the winner. And everybody accepts him as the winner, even though he is riddled with scars. But the only thing the scars show us is that he was in a battle for 10 rounds. That's one example. Come to another example. Sometimes they show on online how these vets come back from overseas, right? From Iraq, they come back home and they surprise their kids in a graduation or, you know, this and that. I want you to imagine one of these soldiers come back from one of their assignments, now, let's say overseas, and they're sitting with the family, and the family is there, you know, the nice big reunion now, right? Celebrating his return, there's cake and there's a barbecue, the whole nine, blah, blah, blah. Then they sit around afterwards, okay? So can you tell us some stories from the battlefield? The front lines, what was it like? Oh my God, I must have been like, you know, just staring at death. He's like, oh, it was crazy, this and that, talking about war stories and how, you know, I lost my men and good friends of mine and blah, 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 and we were right in the trenches and this and that. And one guy is looking at him and thinking, you know what, there's not even a pimple on this guy's face. Forget a scar. He's walking just fine, all 10 fingers, all 10 toes. There's no amputation, there's nothing. Actually, he looks better than he did before he left. were you in that battle? Yeah, I was right there, really. You don't show signs of a battle. The boxer did. Sometimes when us, we kind of go back inwards. And we go through a little bit of, why do I have this fear of rejection? Why am I not stronger than I should be, or I am? And it kind of brings about old scars, maybe some trauma. Who knows? Maybe I have self-confidence issues. I put on a great show, right? Sometimes the ones who are great on social media are the ones that really have the deep-rooted problems. I always say this, right? When a husband sends a nice, beautiful message on social media, happy anniversary to my wife, to my one and only, my love, my sub coach, my heart cheese. Right? All sorts of emojis and pictures and this and that. Those are the couples I'm worried about the most. And sometimes we're afraid to visit scars. Baba, those scars simply mean that you've been in a battle with Shaitan and with yourself. It's okay. You can show up in front of Allah with scars on your body. It will show you that, look, I didn't succumb. I didn't throw the towel in the first round. I went mano a mano with Shaitan. The difference is I'm left standing. Yeah, I lost some iman. I lost a few things. I had a couple of bad years. I fell. I slipped. I was trying to figure it out. But they're scars. But nonetheless, I'm here. I'm still saying La ilaha illallah. And the same way that boxer had his hand raised, inshallah, you'll say, you know what? Enter Jannah. With those scars. All it shows is that you were in a battle. Don't be afraid to look inwards to find out, why am I so scared to be rejected? What am I afraid of? This guy, these people, this email, they don't even know my last name. And they're going to sit there and dictate to me my path? Meanwhile, people who love me, cherish me, are with me, are egging me on, cheering me on, pom-poms, the whole nine. But they don't mean much. Yeah, they're biased. These people, for some reason, I don't know why, they have a grip on me. It's not them. They're an empty canoe. They just trigger what's already inside of you. Remove that, the canoe won't bother you. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Because it is a capacity issue. God says, I will not ask of any, I will not ask you except for that which is part of your capacity. It's not possible. We know how our kids work. We know, for example, how much I can lift, I can do. I won't. I won't ask anything else. Right? If I'm, you know, example I've given before, if I'm sitting there and I'm moving furniture, let's say I'm moving furniture. Right? Let's say we're going to swap the living room. The sofa goes here, the table goes here. Fine, okay. So I asked my little five-year-old guy, okay, Hassan, you grab that end of the couch, and I got this end. On the count of three now, use your knees, boy. Don't use your back, use your knees. Ready? And it goes like this, the sofa. I go, what happened? You didn't lift. Let's try it again. 3, 2, 1, lift. Goes like this. I said, Baba, I'm 5 years old. Can't do it. I can't lift the whole sofa on this side. I don't have the capacity. Like, obviously, I said, but it's foolish of you. Yeah, it's foolish of me to expect more than what this boy can give me. God knows your capacity. He knows your story. He knows your scars. He does. Absolutely, He knows. Doesn't wish to make things difficult on you. مَا يَفْعَلَ اللَّهُ بِعَذَابِكُمْ What will I gain, he says, by punishing you, by making life difficult for you. I don't wish to allow you to drown in your sin. كَتَبَ عَلَى نَفْسِهِ رَحْمَةً I've made mercy wajib upon myself. If namaz is wajib on you, mercy is wajib on me. I can miss salat, but God can't miss His mercy. So look inwards. Figure out the fear. Figure out the rejection. If that means that you travel through old wounds, it's okay. Don't be afraid of those wounds. Sometimes those wounds actually, you know, they open up pathways. Right? One last point and then Masai. Sometimes, you know, when I had my blinds closed and I'm trying to sleep in the morning, and sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of a crack in between the blinds and that light hits me right in my eyes. Right? 7 a.m., 8 a.m., I need some rest. I have a long day ahead of me. Long programs in the evening. I need some rest. And I'm sleeping and I just found my spot in my pillow. Oh. Tossing and turning. And then that sunlight hits me right there. And it wakes me up through a crack of the blinds. Sometimes it's those cracks of our heart where the light enters. Don't be afraid to stand there in front of God scarred. Saying, yes, you know what? When I was 15, 16, I was confused. I made horrible, horrible, horrible things. I'm coming back to you, but I really want to figure this out. I don't want to fear the rejection of others. Because I'll mention this one more time to you. The idea is that we cannot please everybody. It's impossible. If there are 300 people in this whole property right now, and I expect with my 1 45-minute little, you know, small, little, simple, ignorant speech that I'll please everybody, no, there'll be some people that will leave tonight saying, oh, what a waste of time, man. Acha khasa jo hai, we're sitting at home. Came here, listen to this. It's bound to happen. What's an easier equation is not to try to please everybody, but try to please Him. No? 300 versus 1. He's Ya Sari Ar-Rida. He's easily pleased. And it's not easily pleased. It's Sur'at. Sari and it's Sur'at. He gets to pleasure very quickly. Does not take much to please Him. Meaning what? If this is Him and this is His pleasure, He's traveling at a very, very fast speed, God is. That's what Sari' means. He gets there very quickly. People like me, I'm happy with you. One day, next week, voi banda jo hai, my number one dushman. So I understand the idea of acceptance by others at the cost of God. Let's be careful. Identify. And I'm talking to myself right here. Why is there already an existing fear inside of me? And why do I use that to preemptively now damage my path? Those are internal discussions that I think have to happen. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And these sacrifices we have in these nights, they're all made to awaken the conscious, to shake us a little bit. Why do we have to repeat the musibah and the masaib every single night? It softens the heart. When the heart is softened, it's ready now to be molded, to be formed, to be cleansed, to be clean, to be emptied. And so when the tears for Abul Fazl go down your face, stop and ask Allah, Allah, give me that tawfiq to understand a little bit of myself. Man arafa nafsu faqad arafa rabbuhu. If I want to know you, I have to travel through myself. Because tonight is that night. This was the commander of the army of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. Abbas was there, hope was there. Abbas was there, there's still a chance. Habib is gone, Muslim is gone, Ali Akbar is gone. But there's something about the existence of Abbas roaming the tents that they felt like everything will be all right. He was a giant of a man, chosen specifically from a certain khandan and tribe for this very day. On top of that, he had the blood of Amir al-Mu'mineen running through him. If you want one teacher for battle, you want Ali to be your teacher. A glimpse of that in Siffin of a 14-year-old Abbas. If we knew that, if Hussein knew that, the enemies knew that as well. The only man to get to Furat was Abul Fazl Abbas. All these stories you hear that he would stand and small horses would run through his legs are not fictional stories or fantasy stories. That's how large of a man he was. That's why when he entered the Maidan of Karbala, they would scatter. Nobody knew how to face him. He was in his early 30s on the day of Ashura. That's the peak of your Javanian youth. That's when you have a good balance of your intellect and your emotion. But he had this almost immense love for Imam Hussein. Immense love. When he kept asking Imam Hussein, Mawla, give me ijazat. Mawla, give me permission. Mawla, give me permission. Abbas, you are my alamdar. Abbas, you are my alamdar. When the sounds of al-atash get louder and louder, when the heat becomes more and more unbearing, Abbas says, Mawla, at least let me get water. His kids are dying of thirst. He's given the mashk of Sakina, he's given the alam, and Abbas enters the Maidan of Karbala. Source of hope, in the tent now with pride, Sakina. Getting the kids ready, my Ammu Abbas, he's gone for water, he's gone for water, he's gone for water. She never for a moment thought to herself that there's no way he won't come back. It's my Chacha Abbas. So this umid, this hope now. There's water coming. Not for herself. She was a daughter of Hussein, sacrificial daughter. She would tell the small kids, don't worry, soon enough the Al-Atash cry will stop. Soon enough you'll get water. You'll get water soon enough. Abbas roars inside the Maidan of Karbala. The alam is nice and high. Hussein watching from the Khaymah. A boss now is able to somehow either instill so much fear in the enemy or fight off the enemy to go downhill towards Farat, sit there, fill the Mashq of Sakina, and have this moment that all of us now know very well. If Hussein is thirsty, if Ali Akbar is thirsty, if Sakina is thirsty, Abbas is thirsty. If Abbas for that moment took one drink of water at that moment, nobody would have said anything. We call him what? He's wafadar. His loyalty. 1,000 salams to your loyalty, Abu Fazl Abbas, tonight. How could I drink a drop of water when the lips of my Aqa Hussein continue to be dry? How could I drink a drop of water when the Al-Atta sounds are ringing in my ear? Abbas picked up the water, some say, and dropped it. The mashk is filled, the alam is here. Now he roars back into the khaymah. All he wants is get Hussein some water. Get water back to the khaymah. Get water back to the khaymah. If Abbas's purpose was to get water back to the khaymah, Umar ibn Sa'd's purpose was to make sure not a drop of water got back to the khaymah. And now they confront the man. How do you stop this man? You surround him. From far now, you throw arrows. From far now, there's all sorts of spears. There's rocks, everything. They begin slowly but surely now chipping away at the giant nature of this man. There comes a moment now where one mal'oon ambushes Abbas from the trees and chops off his right arm. There comes a moment now where another man comes and chops off his left arm. Now the mashq is in his mouth, the alam between his legs. Get water to Sakina. Get water to Sakina. Hussein watching from the khaymah. Alam now nice and high. It's still high. It would drop and rise again. Drop and rise again. But there comes a moment now where there is a shower of arrows. One hits Abbas in the neck, he removes it. One hits in the shoulder, he removes it. But the one arrow that almost killed the man was the arrow that struck the mashq of Sakina. Water starts pouring out. Now Abbas stops his horse. Abbas stops his horse. No arms to fight, no water to give Sakina. What does this man do? If I go to the khaymah without water, I can't do that. If I turn back and fight the enemy, I don't have any arms. 1,000 salams to the courage and bravery of Abul Fazl Abbas. He turns around. I will not go back. He begins to fight the enemy. How he fought him, who knows? I have no idea. But there comes one arrow that strikes the eye of Abul Fazl Abbas. At that moment now, Abbas falls from the horse. Every year I recite this hadith. Alama Majlisi Rahmatullah Alayh says that I read the Masaib of Abul Fazl Abbas one night. In my dream that night, Shahzadi Konain, Fatima Zahra, comes inside my dreams. Majlisi, you read the Masaib of my Abbas. You never recite the Musiba. You recite the Masaib, not the Musiba. Shahzadi, tell me what the musibah is. Whenever someone sits in a majlis and listens to the masaib of my Abbas, tell them, one by one, tell them, woman, child, man, that when somebody falls that high from the horse, they all use their arms to break their fall. My Abbas didn't have arms to break his fall. He fell on that arrow. Assalamu alayka ya Amir al-Mu'mineen. Assalamu alayka Ya Aba Abdullah. Hussein hears Abbas's cry, comes running into the Maidan of Karbala, places Abbas's head on his lap. Agha, Mawla, Aqa, I'm sorry. If I made you Sharminda, I'm sorry. Do you have any last request? The only shaheed to be left at the banks of Furat was Abbas. Mawla, don't take my mayat back to the khaymah. Mawla, leave my mayat right here alone. Hussein now leaves Abbas by the banks of Furat, grabs the alam and goes back to the khaymah. Bibi Sakina now comes out of the khaymah. She looks at the alam. The alam is there. The alamdar is not there. She turns towards the Maidan of Karbala. Hey, Chacha Abbas, your Sakina is not thirsty anymore. Matam Hussein, Ya Abbas, Ya Hussein.